Right, welcome. Can everybody hear me okay? Excellent, we have one mic that's working. That's always a good start for an evening. So thanks very much for joining for this event. And let me welcome Chris Miller, who's an associate professor at the Fletcher School in Boston, and who I first met, I think at Yale, what, 12 years ago? When we were both hanging out with Paul Kennedy and John Gaddis, big historians at Yale, and reflecting on how the world could get worse than it did. So my name is Alexander Evans. I'm professor in practice in the School of Public Policy at LSE, newly minted. I arrived in August, and by background, I'm a British diplomat. This evening's event is going to be hybrid. We have three co-hosts, which is a fine example of interagency working at LSE. So we have the School of Public Policy, we have the LSE Department of International Relations, which I'm very pleased to be a graduate from many years ago when I had hair. And we have LSE Ideas, which is LSE's foreign policy and strategy think tank. So those are our three co-hosts this evening. But Chris is very kindly agreed to join. You come into London, I think, last night to talk about chip war, the history and geopolitics of semiconductors. There is a new book. We don't do book launches at LSE, but there is a new book called Chip War out at the moment and available from good bookshops. And it's gaining plaudits across the world as crucial reading this autumn. I'm also very pleased to welcome our audience here to this event, both in person but also online, because I'm conscious we'll have a range of people joining us hybrid as well. I won't perhaps talk that much about the issues, because I think, Chris, you're going to talk about that in your remarks. But I would ask you to please put on your phones on silent to avoid the inadvertent robocall from somebody trying to steal your money or sell you something. And the event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. And as usual, there'll be a chance for you to put your questions to our speaker. What we'll do is probably invite Chris to speak for 20 to 30 minutes, have a bit of a conversation down here, and then open it up to questions and answers, if that works for people. So let me just introduce Chris. So Chris is an Associate Professor of International History at the Fletcher School, and he's just written this book on chip war, the fight for the world's most critical technology. He's the author of three other books on history and international affairs. He was previously the Associate Director for Brady Johnson Program in Grand Strategy at Yale, a lecturer at the New Economic School in Moscow, a visiting researcher at the Carnegie Moscow Center, a research associate at the Brookings Institute, and a fellow at the German Marshall Fund's Transatlantic Academy. He got his PhD and MA from Yale and his BA in History from Harvard. And he has the unusual distinction of being sanctioned, is that right? Yeah. Sanctioned by the Russian Federation. So you're looking at somebody who is the sanctioned along with, was it Mike McFaul who got...
most famously was Jill Biden.
Oh yes, with Jill Biden, that's right? Yes. So on the same list as Jill Biden. So you're looking at somebody who poses a clearly mortal threat to the Russian state as well, and perhaps you'll explain more about that in a minute. So Chris, without further ado, please feel free to take floor.
Well, thank you very much. I'll grab that mic since it's our one working mic for this evening. Well, thank you, Alexander, for the introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here with all of you this evening. It's been several years since I was last at LSE, so very nice to be back. Perhaps to start our discussion, I can share with you how I got into the topic of semiconductors, which when I began this research was a topic that I thought was kind of obscure, and many of you might think it's obscure as well. But in fact, what I'd like to suggest is that semiconductors are at the center of the modern world. Economics, politics, military power are all defined by computer chips, and the contest to control the future of computer chips, and ultimately, therefore, the future of computing power is a contest that is at the center stage of international politics today. But I began this research trying to understand the history of semiconductors out of a project that was looking at missile technology during the Cold War. I'm a historian of the Soviet Union by training. My first three books were on the history of the Russian and Soviet economy, and I wanted to ask the question, why was it that the Soviet Union, just like the United States and multiple other countries, could produce atomic weapons, and lots of them? Why was it that the Soviet Union could shoot the first man into space, as well as the first satellite, but they couldn't produce miniaturized computing power, which was fundamentally important for their entire military? Today, we take for granted that missiles can be shot from hundreds of miles away and, in many cases, hit a target with precision accuracy after flying for minutes or even hours. But that is a new technological development in the grand sweep of 20th century history. And for most of the history of warfare, precision was a dream rather than a reality. Well, what's striking is that for some countries, precision still is a dream. It's very hard for some countries to actually adopt, deploy, and effectively use precision technologies. Look at Russia, for example, and its war in Syria, now 8 years in. According to the best estimates by Western and Israeli researchers, 80 to 95% of the bombs Russia has dropped in Syria have been dumb bombs, hardly different than the weapons the UK or the US would have used during World War II. So in fact, there's extraordinary differentiation in terms of countries' ability to miniaturize computing power for the purposes of weapon systems. I wanted to know, well, why was this such an important tool of statecraft, which has defined military power over the past several decades? Some countries can do and others can't, even countries that we normally think of as military powers. If you dig into missile systems, as I did over the course of this research, you'll find that the rockets that move missiles forward through the air are kind of interesting, but actually lots of countries can make them. The metallurgy involved in missiles is complicated, especially when you're talking about missiles that go at higher speeds, above the speed of sound, but ultimately that too is straightforward enough. The difficult part of missiles, and the part that is relevant for our purposes today, is the guidance computer inside. Because miniaturizing computers that they can fit in missiles, so that they can fit today in your pocket inside of your iPhone, has been the most extraordinary manufacturing challenge, not only of the past several decades, but of entire human history. What I'd like to suggest to you today is that the key driver of economic progress, of military power, and of political shifts over the past 75 years has been the struggle to miniaturize computing so it can be deployed in all aspects of human life. Now, if you think back to what computing looked like in 1945, the most advanced computer in the world at the time was the ENIAC computer at the University of Pennsylvania, which was the size of a room. It would have fit more or less in this room, and it had several tens of thousands of vacuum tubes, small light bulb-like devices that turned on and off. When they were on, they produced a one, off, they produced a zero, and that created all of the ones and zeros undergirding all digital computing. And that computer was used to calculate artillery trajectories, useful during World War II, but it had its limitations. For one thing, vacuum tubes regularly broke down. When they turned on and off like light bulbs, they would burn out after a while. Secondly, when they turned on, they created light, attracting bugs, and requiring constant debugging of the machines, the origins of that same process in software today. But the biggest problem is that they were large. They were huge. 20, 30, 40,000 bulbs in a room flashing on and off was all the computing power that one could realistically string together at that time. And so if you wanted to simply calculate artillery trajectories that computer was used for, it was okay. But if you wanted to have computing on the move in a small fashion using limited power, you had to find a way to miniaturize the device producing the ones and zeros that vacuum tubes did. In 1947, a new device was created called a transistor, which was also like a vacuum tube, a sort of switch that turned on and off. And a decade later, in 1958, the first transistor was embedded into a silicon chip, letting it turn on and off with greater reliability, and most importantly, letting it be miniaturized so it could be deployed in smaller use cases. The first chip that was emerged came in 1958, the second chip in 1959, and the early market for these tiny chips, which were plugged into the most advanced computers of the day, was entirely for military systems. The first major order for chips was for the Apollo spacecraft's guidance computer, which sent the Apollo spacecraft to the moon and back. The second major order was for the intercontinental ballistic missile called the Minuteman II, which was designed to send nuclear warheads from the Western United States all the way to Moscow. And after that, semiconductors began being deployed to all sorts of military systems, guidance systems in missiles, communication systems, computing on tanks and aircraft, on ships. And they were crucial because they allowed computers to move from something that would fit in a room to something that would fit on a device that moved, or even miniaturized, they could fit in the nose of a missile. Now, since that time, semiconductors have changed dramatically. Today, most chips go in consumer devices rather than military uses. Only about 2% of chips today end up in a military device, but they're still central to the production of military power. The process of continuing to miniaturize transistors has been the driving force behind all computing advances we have today. Let me just sketch out for you some visualizations of the change that's happened since the late 1950s all the way up to present. The first commercially available chip had four transistors on it, tiny switches that turned on and off, on and off, on and off, available in the early 1960s. Today, if you have a new iPhone, it has 15 billion transistors on just the main chip, and there are multiple chips in your iPhone, the main processor chip, the memory chip, the chip managing the Wi-Fi, chip managing the Bluetooth, chip managing the connection with the cell phone networks, a modem to decode the signals coming from the cell phone networks, a chip managing the camera, the chip managing the auto, the audio, but just the main chip, 15 billion transistors. And so to fit 15 billion transistors on a single piece of silicon requires very, very small transistors. And so on an iPhone, for example, or on a PC, your transistors on which you rely are each smaller than a coronavirus. And manufacturing these chips has been the most difficult manufacturing process in human history. Just for the iPhone alone, for example, a new generation of iPhone comes out, and the company that produces all the chips in an iPhone, called TSMC, the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, produces over a quintillion transistors just for Apple alone. Now, before I started this research, I had no idea what a quintillion was, and I suspect many of you are also not familiar with that number. That's a number with 18 zeros after it. And that's just for one chip in one device produced by one company. The fact is that we produced more transistors just last year than the combined total of all other devices produced in all of human history. We produce more transistors than anything else in the world. There's nothing else that you buy that comes in batches of the billions. And yet for smartphones, computers, and for data centers, that's the only measurement that matters. And the ability to produce these transistors at such tiny scale is the greatest machining challenge that humans have ever faced as well, because you can't manufacture tiny transistors unless you've got the most precise machine tools that have ever been made. If you want to make the chip in your iPhone, for example, you'll need to buy machine tools that are produced above all by five companies, one Dutch, three American, one Japanese, without which it's basically impossible to make an advanced chip. And these machine tools are among the most complex machines ever made. Take, for example, the lithography machine produced by the Dutch company ASML, which has a 100% market share in the production of advanced lithography machines. You probably don't know what lithography is. I didn't either when I started this project. In fact, you can't make a chip without lithography. What lithography means is you have a silicon wafer. All chips, most chips are made out of silicon. You layer a type of chemical on top of it, and then you shine light in the specific pattern you want, and that light interacts with the chemical to carve out a design on the chip. So the process of shining light at the chip is called lithography. For a long time, the chip industry used visible light to carve patterns on chips. Invisible light has a wavelength of several hundred nanometers, which you might think would be small enough for all the manufacturing that you need. But in fact, today with transistors measured only a couple nanometers wide or tall, visible light is far too big for the manufacturing that we require. We need smaller light. And so the Dutch company ASML has developed machines called extreme ultraviolet lithography machines, which produce light at a wavelength of 13.5 nanometers. Very small light. And that's not easy to do, because light at that size is like X-rays. It goes through most materials. So you need to produce a lot of this light, and you need to direct it and acquire it and push it towards the semiconductor that you're trying to carve into. Doing so requires an explosion at several hundred thousand degrees Fahrenheit happening constantly inside of a machine. You create this explosion by dropping balls of tin, each 30 microns, that's millionths of a millimeter wide, hitting it twice with one of the most powerful lasers ever commercialized in a device, exploding it, creating this extraordinary high temperature plasma. And this plasma emits photons at a wavelength of 13.5 nanometers, in sufficient quantity to be collected by the flattest mirrors humans have ever made and then directed towards a silicon wafer. There's no more complex manufacturing process that humans have ever done, which is why this machine is the most expensive machine tool in human history, costing $150 million apiece. But you don't only need one type of machine to make a semiconductor. Similarly complicated machines are needed to lay down layers of thin films, just a couple of atoms tall, or etch tiny canyons into silicon, a couple of atoms wide. Then you need to measure and inspect the semiconductor, make sure there aren't any errors in it. Well, measurement and inspection requires extraordinary machines that are capable of seeing errors that are only several nanometers in dimension. So the machining necessary to make the advanced chips on which we all rely is extraordinarily complicated and has been produced only after decades and decades of investment by a very small number of firms. Once you have the advanced machining you need to produce an advanced semiconductor, you need to learn how to use it to make the most advanced chips. And today there's just three companies in the world that compete to produce the most advanced processor chips. And one of them is far ahead of all the others in terms of its ability to produce with precision and in terms of its ability to produce at scale. And that's the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, as I mentioned, which is one of the most interesting companies in the world, although most people outside of Taiwan have never heard of it. It's the largest publicly traded company in Asia, one of the largest in the world, and every computing device that we can think of relies on their chips. Whether it's phones or computers, telecoms infrastructure or data centers, the world can't function without their chips. And indeed, 90% of the most advanced processor chips are produced by this one company in just a handful of facilities lying on the western side of the island of Taiwan, which arguably makes this company the most important company in the world, because all the other tech companies that we think of, whether it's Apple or Amazon or Tencent or Alibaba, none of them can function without chips produced by TSMC. Indeed, Apple has no other source for the primary chips in its iPhone, and hasn't for almost the last decade. So the chip industry is defined by these extraordinary, this extraordinary complex set of machinery that is controlled by a tiny number of companies in just a handful of countries. And so if you look at what it takes, for example, to make a chip in your iPhone, you'll have chip designers based in the US and Israel using machines, as I mentioned, based from machines coming from the Netherlands, California, and Japan, specialized chemicals often coming from Japan as well, produced in Taiwan. So these small number of countries, Japan, the US, Taiwan, the Netherlands, have an extraordinary choke point over the production of advanced computing worldwide, because unless you have access to production capacities in these four countries, you simply cannot make an advanced chip. Which brings us back to the origins of chips, because just as the early days of the chip industry emerged out of competition between the US and the Soviet Union to produce military power, so too the politics of the day are beginning to reinfect the chip industry. And when you look across the world, you'll find that almost every major power is turning to semiconductors as a tool of political influence. And because there are so many choke points in the semiconductor supply chain, it's possible for many different countries to try to weaponize these choke points to achieve their political goals. Over the past couple of years, for example, the Japanese government has cut off the supply of crucial chemicals to Korean chip makers. Russia earlier this year cut off the supply of...
If that's going, you want to try the one up there, just see if that yeah. works.
Try this one. Is this better? Okay. I think this is working. Russia earlier this year cut off the supply of neon gas, one of the crucial gas uses in chip making, to the rest of the world, trying, failing in this case to... Maybe I'll just talk loudly. Okay. Can I just talk loudly or no? Recording. Uh-oh. Okay. Why don't I put the mic once more then? Slouch around the desk to discuss with you. So countries have been weaponizing the semiconductor supply chain, trying to boost their influence in the semiconductor production process and cut off their adversaries, which is why over the past couple of years, and in particular over the past couple of months, we've seen an intensification of efforts to increase political control over the industry.
Hold the mic higher up. I think you're blocking the sensor on the bottom.
Is that better?
Just try and keep the hand up.
We need more advanced semiconductors for our microphones so that they can properly send their signal through my hand. The greatest challenge, though, to the semiconductor industry today comes from the intensifying rivalry between the United States and China. The Chinese government since 2014 has been pouring tens of billions and probably hundreds of billions of dollars since that time into domesticating its chip industry. The U.S., in response, has been trying to cut off China from accessing the most advanced semiconductor technologies. And this happens all the while the military balance in the Taiwan Straits is shifting dramatically in, see, it wasn't just my hand, it's something beyond that. Okay.
Over here.
Over here, okay.
It'll work.
Okay. All the while, the U.S. and China are seeing a shifting military balance in the Taiwan Straits. So over the past decade, the military balance in the Taiwan Straits has shifted dramatically in China's favor as China's modernized its military and built it up dramatically. The U.S. has not built up its military in the Pacific. In fact, it's been focused on other regions for a long time, the Middle East, more recently on Ukraine. And so there's a deep interrelationship between the military balance in the Taiwan Straits and the struggle for the production of computing power, and of course great risk as well to the world if in fact something were to go wrong in the Taiwan Straits, threatening not only the semiconductor industry, but all of the industries that rely on the production of computing power. Over the past couple of months, the United States has tried to cut off access of Chinese firms to chip making equipment produced in the United States, as well as an advanced type of chip used in AI applications and data centers called GPUs, trying to essentially stop any increase in China's ability to move forward in artificial intelligence by cutting off China's access to advanced computing power. And the goal from the U.S. perspective is to turn the tide in the shifting military balance, to halt the deterioration of America's military position in Asia by reopening scope for a qualitative difference between U.S. and Chinese systems. Because it's obvious to defense planners both in Beijing and in Washington that China will have more military systems in Asia, more missiles, more ships, more airplanes. So the only hope that the U.S. government thinks it has is to defeat quantity with quality. And it's returning to the origins of semiconductors to do that. The bet that the U.S. is making is that by opening a gap between China's ability to access computing power, by preventing China from acquiring the most advanced chip-making machines from the Netherlands, from the United States, and from Japan, it can create a situation where China is unable to produce the most advanced computing and therefore unable to move forward in artificial intelligence for civilian applications, but also for military applications. And so the semiconductor industry on which we all depend, we think it's about smartphones and computers, but when policymakers think about semiconductors, they think first and foremost about military power. And so just as in the early days of the industry, when semiconductors emerged out of demands for miniaturized computing in missile guidance computers, so too the industry is reverting to that historical trend, whereas where all militaries are thinking about access to semiconductors. Some of them have it, others don't. And the balance of military power in the future will be determined in no small part by the question of whether the U.S. is able to keep and grow its edge in the production of computing power, whether China is able to evade the U.S. restrictions and produce domestically the tools it needs to produce advanced computing, or the third option is that something goes wrong in the Taiwan Straits and both countries lose access to the world's most advanced computing facilities. And if that were to happen, it would impact not just the U.S. and China, but anyone who relies on a computer or a smartphone or a cell phone tower or the internet, which is to say almost everyone, because 90% of the world's most advanced processor chips and 1/3 of the world's computing power are produced in Taiwan every year. So the stakes in the Taiwan Straits couldn't be higher, even for someone who doesn't care about Taiwan for its own intrinsic purposes, almost certainly cares about the chips that emerge from Taiwan every year. That's why the struggle to control semiconductors, and as a result, the struggle to control computing power is so important, not just for the companies involved, not just for the commercial stakes, but fundamentally, because that is the question that will determine the military balance in Asia and the relative power of the United States and China. Perhaps I'll stop there, but would welcome questions and comments later.
Chris, thanks very much. A tour de force, given without notes. This is a great sign of a policy school training as well as a historian's training. So look, I just want to ask a few questions, if I may. The first question really is about the fact that you're a historian, and yet you teach in a policy school. So why is it important for us to be conscious of history when we're thinking about technology and geopolitics?
When I started this research almost half a decade ago, it's just me after bad luck with the microphone. One of the striking things is that we were in the early days of bifurcation, technological bifurcation between the US and China. And if you talk to people in the industry who had spent their careers building very complex supply chains that crisscrossed borders across, across the world, and especially across the Pacific, one of the things that you often heard is that it's simply impossible to imagine supply chains being unraveled. And I did that as a historian and said, well, wait a minute, it might not be a good thing, but we've seen this many times before. The US, the UK and Germany were each other's largest trading partners in 1914 until in a matter of a month they weren't. And there are many other examples of rapid economic decoupling, which isn't to say it's a good thing, but to say that history suggests it's certainly possible. And I think when you look at tech, you have lots of people who are focused on the future, for which they ought to be commended. It's great to think about the future, but the reality is that the future of tech policy will be shaped by trends that we've seen in the past, whether it's the balance of political and economic forces, struggles for political power. These are all themes that you can study historically, because ultimately, although history doesn't repeat itself, there are reoccurring patterns that one can draw from. And I do worry about technology in particular. Whenever a new technology emerges, there's a discourse that companies said that this time is really different. This time it's really new. This time it's really going to change paradigms in a way that you don't know how to think about. And the reality is that it's never all new. There are always historical contexts that can help explain it. And I think when we hear about new technologies and think about advanced computing capabilities and artificial intelligence, the way that's going to change the world, that's undoubtedly true in a sense. But actually, there are lots of previous tech transitions that we can learn from, and learn from not only to guide where this technology is going, but also predict the policy impacts that will shape the technology.
Thanks very much. And I mean, it didn't necessarily get remarked on very much in the UK, but in the UK, or one of the previous UK governments, we're changing quite frequently at the moment. It's a little national habit we've got into. But the 2021 integrated review of foreign policy and defence policy by the UK government talks about regulatory diplomacy as quite a major theme within it. And that was very much intended as a clear signal on the importance of this diplomacy around standards and technology and anticipatory policy making. And it's not, you know, it's not the most exciting of subjects for many people unless you make it real, as you have just done. Can I ask a sort of different question? You know, we met on the east coast of the US, the sort of a preppy world of carefully tucked shirts and Ivy League institutions. It's a bit different to the beach culture and the go-getting entrepreneurship of the West Coast. Your research on this has required you to engage with both the State Department and Silicon Valley, which anthropologists I think would describe as being a little bit different. How important is it to try and get these two cultures to connect? And how do you go about doing that if you're gonna have informed tech policy?
Yeah, that's a very interesting and challenging question to answer. I think I would say a couple of things in response. The first is that if you want to understand technology, you've got to understand not only the technology, but also the business models that make it possible. And one of the things that I'm struck by in talking with policymakers, especially in the national security field, is the extent to which they're not trained to think about business models, and yet business models are absolutely crucial in understanding how technology changes and which technologies are deployed. In the semiconductor space, for example, the amount of capital investment required for most of the industry means that you have to have massive scale to be at all economically viable. And in the business, this is so obvious that no one even talks about it because everyone intrinsically knows it. But in the security community, this is something people don't naturally think about because they're engaged in other activities. And so thinking hard about what are the business models that are necessary for technology is something that I think people on the policy side have more work to do. On the tech side, I think there's also work to be done in terms of having a conversation between the two sides. And in particular, I think on tech companies, their internal cultures are all about celebrating how different they are and everything they're planning to disrupt. And you need to disrupt something, you're going to be a successful tech firm. But the reality is that you're probably disrupting less than you think. And indeed, engagement with policymakers is inevitably going to be part of the tech process. And even the companies that are most vocal about how independent they are and how much they're overthrowing the established order in reality have vast lobbying arms and a lot of engagement with policymakers in a whole variety of spheres. And so I think we should ask tough questions about tech companies who claim to be simply disrupting the established order, never engaging with government, because the reality is they often do, they just aren't nearly as thoughtful about it as the way they can be. Final point, I think, is that for too long, I think policy schools and policy apparatuses have not thought hard enough about having baseline knowledge in key technologies. Semiconductors is an advantage. I think is an example of that. I think biotech is another example where it hasn't been seen as core to the competencies one needs to move up in the policy sphere. But the reality is that you can't have an impact, you can't understand the environment you're operating with unless you have some basic understanding of the technologies at play. And so I think there is some work to be done on the policy side of actually doing a bit more homework in terms of what the technologies are that we're actually trying to understand and regulate.
Sticking with policy communities for a moment, I enjoyed some of your research looking at the Soviet experiment at simulating Silicon Valley, which I think was just a bit colder and less of a fast follow than a fast fail. But I just wondered, how would you contrast, as it were, that failed Soviet effort to build a culture of science and precision engineering and innovation with China's contemporary investment in and commitment to modernize its tech R&D base?
If you ask yourself, why did the Soviet Union fail to miniaturize computing power? I think there's a lot of explanations that can be pretty quickly ruled out. It wasn't that there wasn't a base of science in the Soviet Union. In fact, the Soviet Union had brilliant physicists, some of whom even won Nobel Prizes in semiconductor physics. So it wasn't a science problem. Nor was it a capital investment problem. The Soviets poured lots and lots of funds into building out facilities and spent really substantial resources in trying to support the industry. So it wasn't a deficit of money either. I think two things stand out. First is that the scale that Silicon Valley was able to access was far larger because the Soviet Union was selling to the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, and that was basically it. And they didn't have a consumer market domestically, so scale was really quite tiny. By contrast, in the West, there was a vast global market from Japan to the US to Europe that you could sell to, and it was a consumer market that grew over time. So that allowed scaling, which allowed improved manufacturing processes over time as you learn from having scaled, which in turn fed into more funds for R&D and future capital investment. So the scale really matters, and in advanced technologies that are capital intensive, if you're selling to a small share of the world economy and your competitors are selling to a large share of the world economy, you're almost certainly going to lose. And so that's a lesson that is relevant for China in two directions. In the past, China's strategy has been to target global markets. Now I think there's a chance that that's changing, and China's focusing on the domestic market, which, of course, China is a big domestic market, and it has a consumer market, but it's still a fraction of the world economy relative to the rest of the market, what the Taiwanese and the South Korean and the U.S. firms can sell to. So that's one lesson I would draw from the Soviet experience about scale and the need for global markets. The second is about copying. It's clear that you can learn a lot in terms of technology from copying in certain spheres. So we know, for example, that intelligence operations have played a tremendously important role in the diffusion of nuclear knowledge across the world, whether the Soviet spying program in the United States or the network of AQ-Khan. Spreading information via espionage has been really important in certain technological spheres. But others are different. And the key question is, how quickly does your technology change? So nuclear weapons have barely changed since the 1960s. There haven't been major advances in terms of how the bombs actually blow off, which is why even the North Koreans can create a nuclear weapon. North Koreans have hardly any domestic technological base, but even they have nuclear weapons. By contrast, semiconductors improve at the rate dictated by Moore's Law, named after Gordon Moore, the founder of Intel, who said that, to kind of simplify a bit, he said that the amount of computing power that a chip will produce will double annually. Well, that's a really hard rate to keep up with. And if you're trying to copy, you're going to be copying technology that is very quickly going to be out of date. So the Soviets did try to copy. They regularly used designs from Intel or Texas Instruments in their military systems. And they even acquired US manufacturing equipment that measured in inches, despite that the rest of the country was measured in the metric system, to facilitate copying of the United States. And they copied very successfully, but they're always a decade late. I think that speaks to the difficulties of copying an industry that moves forward with exponential growth rates. And maybe just one final thing to kind of contextualize what an exponential growth rate means. You know, imagine if airplanes flew twice as fast every 2 years, or houses were built twice as big at the same price every 2 years, or sandwiches taste twice as good every 2 years. It's incomprehensible in most parts of the economy, but in computing it's been delivered for half a century. And we take it for granted to the extent that we don't even realize that the number of transistors we have access to do thinking for us doubles every 2 years. It's a rate of change that is so far ahead of any other rate of change we see in the economy, it's almost unthinkable. And so that's a really hard rate to catch up to.
Thanks very much. And one of the challenges around schools of public policy is that sense that they've been a bit sort of Euro-Atlantic. You know, the focus has been sort of America and Europe, not really focused on the global diversity of policymaking, of change, of challenges for governments. You're a rare person in the policy world because you do actually speak and work in Russian. You've worked in archives in Russia and elsewhere. How important is that linguistic ability to reach into the decision-making and the archives of another culture to again, understanding comparative trends in geopolitics?
Well, I think it is fundamentally important. I wouldn't have reached this topic had it not been for my expertise in Soviet history, which sounds at the outset like an absurd thing to say. An industry in which Russia plays a minuscule role in today and has hardly any technological capabilities today, I approached from the perspective of Russian history, but that's the reality. And you're only, I think, able to find interesting research topics by digging deeply into the history of other countries or the politics of other countries. And if it hadn't been for Soviet archives, which I had the ability to consult over the course of this research, I wouldn't have designed the project in the way I did, nor would I have realized the central role that military competition played in setting up this industry. So I think it is crucial. I mean, I will say that I, over the course of this book, did research on a variety of countries, not only Russia. And I think even for countries that I am far from an expert in, like Taiwan, nevertheless, you learn a lot about how to understand a country's politics, its political economy, having studied that in other contexts. So even there, I would say, I benefited a lot from my area of studies expertise in Russia and Eurasia.
So final question before we open it up for a more interactive session is really around sort of, you know, what do governments do around this challenge of tech policy and change? We had a Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, who decided to give an UNGUS speech in 2019 solely about technology, remembered a bit more for language about Terminators than the fact that he'd chosen to focus entirely on technology. In the UK government, we've set up an Office for Science and Technology Strategy in the Cabinet Office. We set up an Advanced Research and Invention Agency, ARIA, effectively a British version of DARPA. But you know, these are kind of steps along the way. So if there was one bit of advice you would give, ideally for free, to the British, what would you say is most important in terms of turning a government machine into something that's more capable of understanding this exponential rate of change?
Can I give two pieces of advice?
Of course.
I guess two. First piece, I think, one of the interesting conclusions from US experience is that a lot of critical technologies that we take for granted today were first funded by DARPA, the Defense Department's Advanced Projects Research Agency. And DARPA has a really unique status within the US government because it's hidden away in a vast Pentagon budget, such that it's kind of a rounding error in the perspective of the Pentagon's budget. And so no one really looks very closely at what they're doing, which is absolutely critical. Because if Congress knew what they were doing, they would know that their failure rate is pretty high. They'd ask questions about, is our money going in the right place? And the answer they might get would be, well, we're not sure, hard to assess. And the reality is you can only assess this after decades, including a failure rate that's above 50%. So in democracies, it's very hard, I think, to maintain investment in moonshot technologies, because people will naturally ask, well, what about the failures? And there's a lot of failures. And so the more you can do to hide them away from public scrutiny, I think actually the better. Now you need some transparency, you need some oversight, but the reality is that that there's a risk of too much short-term oversight. And the US had this experience with the Energy Department's similar advanced project research agency, which was set up a decade ago, invested in some failed solar projects, and faced immense scrutiny over why were they investing so badly? And as a result, we were shut down quickly afterwards. So I think there's a lot of reason to keep your tech R&D shielded from the kind of the short-term whims of legislators concerned about short-term returns. The reality is returns will only come in the long run. So if you assess them over a 1 year or 2 year or 5 year time horizon, you will assess them badly. That's the first thing. I think the second thing is that for governments to make smart technology policy, they need smart technology advice. And that takes resources that must be developed inside a government to study technological change. Now, governments have lots of different ways of tapping into expertise throughout their networks. Health systems know about changes in biomedical research. Defense establishments know about changes in material science and manufacturing. But I think it actually helps to have more centralized knowledge, both tracking changes that are underway, understanding what's driving them economically and technologically, and forecasting where they might go. And so I think there's a strong rationale for having a small but well-resourced bureaucracy close to decision makers that is helping them understand what are the key technological trends and where are they headed. Otherwise, you can't expect political leaders to be well-versed on quantum computing or gene editing. That's just not something that politicians naturally pick up over the course of campaigning, for example.
Chris, thanks very much. Well, let's open it up now. We've got probably about 20 minutes left, so who would like to ask a question? Perhaps take one here first.
Hi, I've got a couple of questions. Sorry. One's about the whole situation with Taiwan. So obviously, as you mentioned, Taiwan is very, very important in the world of semiconductors. Say there was a war between the US and China, which might happen, and that factory got destroyed. What would happen? What would be the aftermath? Would we enter a new dark ages? Would it destroy civilization as we know it? Like, what would be the after effects? Another one is, I don't know, you've probably heard of this, it's a book by Kai-Fu Lee, AI Superpowers. And what he was talking about was that basically the war between the US and China over AI development and tech and things, they're the only countries that have got the economies of scale to basically take full advantage of the fourth industrial revolution, which is the AI revolution. And talks a lot about how this is just basically going to create, basically those two countries will be the only ones benefiting, and it just increase inequality for everyone. So what's the fate for the rest of the world? Like, obviously the UK likes to talk a lot about how it's investing in tech, but I don't really see what they're doing. So what's the future? Are we and the rest of Europe going to become really antiquated? Are their economies going to rise really high? They'll be really advanced and the rest of the world lags behind. Sorry if these are complicated questions.
So to start with the question of what happens if there's a China-Taiwan war. If there's a shooting war in the Taiwan Straits, I think we have to assume that the semiconductor facilities get destroyed or are not operational. First, they're full of the most precise machinery ever invented, so not well suited for a war zone. Second, if it looks like China's going to succeed in taking Taiwan, I think we have to assume that someone either in the Taiwanese military or other militaries will destroy the facilities. Third, if by some miracle they're intact after the war, they'll only operate if almost all the personnel are still there and still operating the facility and not trying to sabotage the facility. Fourth, even if all those conditions are met, they only function with chemicals imported from Japan, with machine tools that are still imported from the US, Japan, and the Netherlands, and require regular spare parts and software updates. So it's basically impossible to imagine that if China were to attack Taiwan, it would get the chip facilities intact. So what does that mean? So today, Taiwan produces, as I mentioned, 90% of the world's most advanced processor chips and 1/3 of the computing power that we add each year. That would be very bad. Smartphone production would go to something close to zero, I think, the next year. That's a $500 trillion market right there. Most application processors and smartphones are made in Taiwan, as well as a bunch of the other chips inside of smartphones. A third or so of PC processors are made in Taiwan. That would disappear. For data centers, any sort of advanced AI chip in a data center largely comes from Taiwan. Telecoms infrastructure rollout would grind to a halt. It's basically impossible to make a cell phone tower without chips from Taiwan today. And then the rest of the economy that relies on semiconductors, cars, microwaves, dishwashers, would face wrenching delays. Just to give you an example, you probably heard that the last couple of years were marked by a semiconductor shortage. And that's true, causing massive delays across manufacturing, over $200 billion damage to the global auto industry because of delays to car production. The semiconductor shortage happened despite that in 2020, the number of integrated circuits produced globally increased by 8%. And in 2021, the number of chips produced globally increased by a double-digit rate. So we had a semiconductor shortage despite a massive increase in output because demand outstripped supply. Okay, so run that forward with a 1/3 reduction in processor chips produced and a 90% reduction in advanced processor chips. It would be an economic disaster measured in the many trillions of dollars, not just for China and Taiwan, but for the rest of the world. It would, I think, make the economic downturn caused by COVID look mild by comparison. So I hope there's not a China Taiwan war for that reason and others. Second question on AI. If you ask yourself, what do you need why is it that we're talking more about AI today than we did 10 years ago? Is it because AI algorithms are multiple times better or computer programmers multiple times smarter than 10 years ago? Or is it because they have multiple times more transistors to churn their algorithms on? It's obviously the latter. And so when you think about AI, you need algorithms, you need some data for them to chew on, and you need a lot of processing power. And processing power is basically a question of the number of transistors you have, with a little bit about how intelligent those transistors are arrayed on a chip. So the future of AI is basically a question of, can we get the computing power we need to make possible more advances and more applications in AI throughout the economy? So the race for the future of AI is just a question of who's got access to the most transistors, and will Moore's law continue in a way that keeps giving us more transistors on an annual basis? And so that's, I think, the key question. Now, if you look at the question of who can access the most advanced chips with the most transistors on them, until recently the answer was basically everyone. But as of earlier this month, that's no longer the case because the Biden administration has restricted the export of advanced graphics processor units to China and will restrict them going forward. So these are the key chips that run AI applications and data centers. And so going forward, the rest of the world will have access to AI chips to put in its data centers, and China will not. So there's going to be a growing gap between the computing power we can get in data center in China and in Singapore or in Japan or in the US or anywhere else. And so I think if we had Kai-Fu Lee here, he would probably admit that he has to revise his thesis. Because there is going to be an enormous gap opening up in terms of access to computing power. And again, think about Moore's law, which provides you a doubling of transistors, doubling computing power every year. As you run that forward, that gap begins to become very, very important. And so that, I think, would be the key factor in the AI race that you mentioned.
Can I just go up here first?
Thank you. My name's Andrew Peeble. I'm a journalist with The Wire China. So I first wanted to thank you because we had a
extract from your book this last weekend, and we've got an interview coming out with you this coming weekend. So thanks for filling our website. But just a question on China. What's your assessment, what's your judgment of how effective US policy, this policy of sort of attacking the choke points in the semiconductor supply chain has been? And what's your assessment of how the extent to which that is hobbling China's efforts to create its own chip industry? And just secondly, following on from what you were just saying, to what extent do you think actually the sort of centrality of TSMC to this whole ecosystem is a sort of disincentive almost actually for China to wage a war of aggression on Taiwan? Because after all, China has a lot of iPhones and so on and so forth, things that rely on TSMC chips. So those are my two questions. Thank you.
So in terms of measuring the efficacy of controls, I think you can answer that question at multiple levels. So the goal of the controls is to open up a gap between US and Chinese military power in terms of quality of systems. And so that the efficacy of that will be measured in 10 years' time when we see whether that gap has in fact opened up. And so that requires the US to design better systems using new computing power, and B, will depend on whether China finds ways around it. So that goal, the answer is too soon to tell whether it's effective or not. Whether it's effective in a sort of more narrow sense in restraining Chinese advances, I think the answer is pretty clearly in most cases yes. If you ask yourself what routes does China have around the key choke points, the answer is not very many. So for example, chip design software. There are three companies that monopolize chip design software. They're all in the United States. Can China design its own chip design software? Almost certainly, in a couple of years. It'll not be cheap, but it's doable. Can China design the machine tools with which chips are made? That's a much more difficult task. I just described to you earlier one of the machine tools that's used to produce advanced chips. Replicating that, not just replicating it and also replicating its performance characteristics, almost perfect, constantly running, rarely breaking, producing with almost perfect accuracy, is an extraordinary task, and it's taken ASML 3 decades to do it. So can China do it in a decade's time? Possibly. But in a couple of years' time, I think that's basically impossible. And it's not just lithography, there's deposition and etching, et cetera, a whole different suite of tools that you need. So I think we should assume that these controls will be effective at cutting off China's ability to produce advanced chips at scale. Your second question was?
Disincentive.
Look, I hope you're right. I hope you're right that that the fact that a China-Taiwan war would be disastrous for China as well as for the rest of us is correct. I think the thesis in general that economic interdependence produces peace is one that has been put forward often, tested often historically, and found sometimes to work. And so that leaves me somewhat nervous looking at the situation. And I think it's difficult as an observer of Chinese and Taiwanese politics and military affairs, and the US-China military balance, which has again swung pretty decisively in China's direction, to conclude that the risk of war is declining. I think it's pretty clearly increased pretty dramatically over the past couple of years. So it still may be that China decides not to for economic reasons, and a war would be disastrous for China economically as for us. But I think we also need to be realistic about the fact that we were told the same thing about Russia and Germany earlier this year, and that hasn't stopped Russia literally from blowing up the pipelines that sent Germany gas for a very long time. So I think anyone who is hoping for mutually assured economic dependence providing peace, I think needs to look seriously at what the historical record shows and think seriously about whether China's leaders think perhaps correctly that they're more able to sustain economic costs given the domestic political system than other countries are, which might be correct and might be an incentive to risk it.
Should we go to Professor Cable?
Thank you. Further to your advice to the British, one of the few claims that the British would have to be players in this world is the company arm and chip design. So how important is it in this big picture? What should the British government be doing to make sure it remains a British strategic asset?
Arm is a critically important company. It provides the design architecture undergirding most chips in mobile devices, so cell phones or tablets, many IoT devices and other things devices, and some a fairly small amount of data center chips. So it's a really important company, and its intellectual property is found in a device in everyone in this room's pocket. Is it going to define the future of the industry? Well, maybe. But there's a lot of competition that Arm is facing in non-smartphone markets, and in particular in the data center, which is a key growth area for the industry because of all the demands for AI. Arm has a lot of competition from GPUs, from RISC-V, an alternative free processing or chip architecture. So there's no guarantee that Arm retains its position that it has today of sort of a monopolistic role in certain subsets of the market. So that's an open question. What should the UK government do? You know, the reality is that Arm is a UK government, but like a UK company, but like many in the chip industry, it's international. It's got a big office and a lot of staff in California as well. And then most interestingly, it's in the middle of a complicated legal dispute with its China arm. It divested its China unit, and then it's in the middle of a legal battle over who controls the China unit with the former CEO. So the biggest risk might actually be control of this licensing unit in China. I think that might actually be more important than the question of which stock exchanges Arm listed on or where its headquarters formally are. It's worth remembering it's a UK company, but it's been owned by Japan SoftBank for the past couple of years, which hasn't reduced its importance for the UK or its importance in the industry.
Great. Shall we, let's go up the back, maybe to this side, if that's right. Back up there. And perhaps if we could collect a question from there, and then maybe was there another one? This lady here afterwards, and then.
Hi, thanks for coming today. My first question is about in the beginning of the book, you mentioned the amazing stories of the founders of the. You mentioned the amazing story at the beginning for World War II. From the founders of those Asian companies in the semiconductor industry. So my question was, why do you think Eastern Asia was such a fruitful ecosystem for the industry as opposed to other regions? And so that's more about history. And moving to current events, what's your view on the perspective for Europe in the war for chips, because we talk about this opposition between the US and China, and we often say that Europe missed the last few revolutions, whether it's for instance the internet. So do you think Europe's got a role to play in this global war? Thank you.
You want to take that? Let's just take this question as well, if that's all right. Yes, thank you.
Thanks very much for coming. I read your book with great interest. And one of the things that I thought was so striking was it's not just the TSMC choke point that you so rightly identify and emphasize, but also the ASML one that you mentioned as well, the lithography company that's in Dutch, that's a subsidiary of Philips. So
it used to be.
So we've got actually two key vulnerabilities there. So that's quite worrying, neither of which can be really easily replicated in terms of its complex, its cost prohibitive. The idea of this mutually assured destruction model that we had of it's not in anyone's interest for there to be a war between the United States and China over Taiwan, ignores the risk of accidents, natural disasters, terrorism, other people who would be completely happy taking out either of these companies, not just TSMC, but identifying any of the choke points. You could even use your book as a manual for how to do so. So how do we mitigate against that risk? Because the obvious risk is the one we've just been describing, but the non-obvious risk is somebody taking out ASML or North Korea getting involved, because North Korea doesn't care if China and the United States both go get blasted back into the dark ages. It might actually like that. Or somebody just doing it for ransom,
That's an interesting set of questions. I think, so on the natural disasters front, to start there, it's certainly the case that many key parts of the chip industry are in earthquake-prone zones. Taiwan, for example, is one case in point. Now, most chip-making facilities are, the way the buildings are constructed gives them a whole lot of protection from earthquakes. So I've been told that TSMC believes its facilities can withstand a 9.0 earthquake, which there have been five in the past century, not in Taiwan. So hopefully that gives us a bit of confidence that they'll survive, although, you know, I wouldn't want to test that, that size earthquake. In Japan, about a decade ago, earthquake and then tsunami caused disruptions to chip making in Japan. Thankfully, the Netherlands does not have a lot of seismic activity, though certainly one can envision other natural disasters that might happen. So yes, it's a risk. The challenge is that because of the scale you need in the industry, there's no way to divide up production so that it's in multiple different factories in multiple different continents very easily. You can do it, but it's costly. Right now, the US and Japanese governments are in the process of providing incentives to TSMC to build facilities in their countries. This is a very, very expensive prospect because a new chip-making facility at the advanced level costs around $20 billion. So you can't buy very many of those, even for a large sum of money. Compare that, for example, to an aircraft carrier, which costs $10 billion. And this is an enormous sum of money, and they only last for a couple of years before they're out of date, and they need to be replaced by yet another cutting-edge chip fab. So it's hard and expensive to diversify. But yes, I think the risks of concentration that you cite are indeed real. I hope no one uses my book as a manual. On the question of why Asia and why not Europe, if you look at the question. So why Asia? The first offshore assembly facility in Hong Kong was established 3 years after Bob Noyce, one of the co-inventors of the integrated circuit, first did so. So there's been a really deep connection between Silicon Valley and assembly and then later fabrication facilities in Asia since the early 1960s. The initial driver was labor cost differentials. It was cheaper to have assembly workers there than elsewhere. But that's not the key driver today. Actually, the key driver today is other types of cost differentials. Labor differentials matter a bit, but more important, tax policy differentials, government incentive differentials, cost of land, cost of electricity. These are all inputs into the cost differential. And so if you want to build an advanced semiconductor facility today, it costs 20-30% less to do it in Taiwan or Korea than in the United States. And in China, given the additional subsidies, it's even cheaper. So that's the key driver of where fabrication takes place. Not the only one, because the capabilities of companies matters a lot too, but that's the key driver of the shift in fabrication to East Asia. In terms of Europe, Europe still does play a really important role in certain parts of the supply chain. ASML is the best example, but there are many others in terms of the chemicals needed for chip making, the gases. Many are produced by European firms. So actually, Europe does have pretty high value and important parts of the chip making process. It doesn't have large-scale fabrication at the leading edge, so it has a lot of fabrication at the lagging edge. So if you look at chips that go into cars, for example, Europe is a major producer. And that can actually, depending on which specific type of chip you're talking about, that can actually be a really valuable place to be if you've got a specialization. So what I would advise European policymakers is not to try to be better than Taiwan, because Taiwan's going to be the best Taiwan, but to find other niches where you can have a profitable and sustainable edge. And Europe already has that, and I think there's plenty of scope to focus on that in the future.
Terrific. Well, look, thanks very much, Chris. I'm struck, academic books should never be used as manuals. There's a great lesson on this from the 1970s. There was an academic who wrote a book on coups. And the second edition has a lovely introduction. It says, a copy of my book was recently discovered in country X. It was in West Africa. Heavily annotated, seize a radio station first, move against the presidential palace. He says, the coup plotters were all executed. And I would just like to remind readers that this is an academic study of coups, not a manual. And if it was a manual, please don't annotate the book too hard. So for those of you who like annotating your books, there's a lesson for us all. Look, it remains for me to say, a huge pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us this evening and online. Thanks to Chris for coming along and speaking. A fabulous and fascinating exchange. You can order your book from obviously all good places where books are sold, but the LSE has an independent bookshop, Pages of Hackney, where all books available are sold. And there's a link from the event page to that. And thanks very much, and we look forward to welcoming you back to another SPP LSE Ideas and LSE International Relations Department event very soon. So I hope you'll join me in perhaps just raising your hands for Chris.